families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Poet and writer Kathleen Norris is our guest this afternoon. She joins us to talk about poetry, her work, and her memoir, which is just out this spring. It's titled The Virgin of Bennington. The Virgin of Bennington is a coming-of-age memoir that takes readers through Norris's transformation from a shy, sheltered freshman at Bennington College to a successful writer and poet. Following graduation, Norris found a job and a wonderful mentor in New York City. She worked for Elizabeth Cray at the Academy of American Poets. In that job, she went to poetry readings night after night, meeting America's greatest poets. Kathleen Norris is the author of three collections of poetry, strike that, four collections of poetry, and four books of nonfiction. In addition to The Virgin of Bennington, her nonfiction includes Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith. Her books of poetry include Little Girls in Church and The Middle of the World, and just out, Journey, New and Selected Poems, 1969 to 1999. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Kathleen Norris in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Kathleen Norris joins us this afternoon from Chicago, where this evening she will be reading at the Bookstall in Winnetka, Illinois. That's set for 7:30 this evening. Kathleen Norris, good afternoon. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be back.
Nice to talk with you again.
Yes.
Well, talk with us first about this wonderful woman, Elizabeth Cray. Everyone should have an Elizabeth Cray.
I think, yeah, someone who was a born mentor and would say things to me, you know, in my first post-college job working at this wonderful poetry place. Very enthusiastic, loving New York, after not expecting to, but all, you know, all these things. I was a very young woman, and she would say things to me, you know. She said, I had goofed something up at the job, and I said, I hope you're not disappointed in me. And she said, no, I would be disappointed in you if you were still in this job 10 years from now. Mm. You know, that sort of nudge that only a true mentor can give you. So I knew that while I was living, really had found for me the perfect post-college job, I had better start thinking about moving on, something else, you know. And Betty was the only person I met really in Manhattan who understood that moving to South Dakota from Manhattan would be a wonderful thing for me as a writer. She just had a deep understanding, but of so many things. And her friendships with poets really go back to the early 50s when she became an agent for E.E. Cummings when he did readings, and then Robert Frost and Marianne Moore sometimes. And that was a radical thing to do then. I mean, poetry readings were not nearly as common mm-hmm. then as they are now.
Yeah, today it's almost cliche to say that poetry should be spoken.
Oh, I know. And in 1959, one of the things I quote in the book, Betty had to file a report with a plea for money with the Rockefeller Foundation, and the title is something like A Justification for Reading Poetry Aloud in the Public.
That's something else.
Come a long way in 40 years. Yeah.
And she was a champion for young poets who were finding voice in the 1960s.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, she was a freelance agent, but then she moved into directing the Poetry Center at the Y, and the first thing she did was, well, she got money from the Rockefeller Foundation to include younger poets, because they had basically been having the same poets read every year, but they were really big names like Carl Sandburg, Robert Frost, the Sitwells would come over from England, Robert Graves, I mean, wonderful T.S. Eliot, W.H. Auden, all these very well-known names, and Betty persisted in establishing a young poet series. And so I think Anne Sexton and Donald Hall read there, I mean, even before their first books were published. And she scoured the country. She basically got older writers from every part of the country to act as her advisors and say, who are you reading in the magazines? Who do you see that might be, you know, good to come to New York? And that William Stafford did his first New York reading for Betty. She just, you know, loved poets and loved poetry and spent about 35 years of her life helping them out. And you know, when she died, Stanley Kunitz said, American poets have just lost one of the best friends they ever had.
Mm. And I had never heard of her before reading your book.
Well, I think a lot of people will have that experience, and that was partly the way Betty wanted it. I mean, she wasn't a frustrated writer. She was doing what she loved, and she wanted to remain behind the scenes. But when she died, I remember her husband, who was a well-known composer himself, Vladimir Uzichevsky, you know, really wanted somebody to, he wanted me, in fact, to write a book about her. And so this is actually a project I've been dreaming of and trying to figure out how to do for about 14 years.
So when
honor
did
her, honor her memory, yeah, really, and tell about her, because it really is a fascinating story, I think.
Yeah, and another thing that this book will do for readers, I think, is you're just chomping at the bit to get to the library, the bookstore, to immerse yourself in poetry and all the great voices, all the great names, all the great poets that you find between the two covers of the book.
Good, I hope so. I mean, that was one of the reasons I wrote it, you know, because this is autobiography. I mean, it's very much my own coming-of-age story. But I certainly didn't want to focus on myself. I wanted to focus on the wonderful poets I was meeting. Like my hearing Denise Levertov read for the first time in New York City was, you know, so exciting. Meeting Jim Carroll, who became a friend of mine when we were both in our early 20s, just starting out in New York, and he was just writing the Basketball Diaries then, you know, and things like that. Stories I've carried around with me, and I just am finally glad to have been able to tell.
Yeah. One other name I want you to talk about, James Wright.
Oh, yes. James Wright, he died now over 10 years ago. I don't know how much his name, I think he still taught very much, you know, in writing courses on college campuses. But I think, you know, one of the great Midwestern poets, I think, from Ohio, with a vision that surpasses boundaries. And he was a great influence on me in college. When I was a senior, his books like The Branch Will Not Break, Shall We Gather at the River, were just coming out. And for the first time, I was encountering poems that seemed like poetry I wanted to write. They had a very plain-spoken voice, but there was a lot of emotion behind the very simple language. And his work was a revelation to me. And, of course, naturally, he turned out to be a very old friend of Betty. And and I ended up typing his manuscript for his collected poems. And then when I first met my husband, we ended up subletting James and Annie Wright's apartment in New York. That was the first place my husband and I lived together. So he figures in the book quite a bit. And he was marvelous. And he knew most of Walt Whitman by heart, which is a lot. And he would love to quote bad Walt Whitman. There's a lot of very, very bad lines. And one time I was taking him out to a reading. We were doing readings in public libraries. We were on the subway going to Flushing, Queens, this little, you know, outlying library, and James Wright started quoting bad Walt Whitman, reciting it or rating it at top volume on the subway. And, of course, I was laughing. The people in the car thought, okay, we've got another crazy here, but it was just hilarious. I mean, he was a delightful man, and he's one of the other people that I miss. You know, I miss Betty, too, even though she's been dead now for some years.
Yeah.
But these people just made such an impression on me. I had to share it.
These people, most of them, a great number of them, great teachers as well as great poets.
Yeah, I was in a, like a lot of young people, you know, I was very lonely in the city and sort of misguided. I was adrift. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And at one point, Betty said, you know, why don't you go down to Hunter College and let you take some time off from work a couple afternoons a week. And James Wright is teaching a course on the 18th century novel. It'll get your mind on other things, you know, get you reading other books. And so I went down. I spent a whole semester doing that. And it really did jolt me out of my doldrums.
Mm. When did you arrive in New York?
I went to Bennington College in Vermont from 65 to 69, you know, and I was this very sheltered kid from Hawaii. I didn't know that it was possible for kids my age to see psychiatrists and take drugs. I mean, I was so naive. And of course, I walked into the maelstrom of the mid-1960s on the East Coast. And then I was very nervous about New York. I really avoided New York for most of the 4 years that I was at Bennington. But in my senior year, I became a little more, you know, bold about it, and I ended up actually moving there right after graduation in the fall of 69.
Mm. And you interviewed with Elizabeth Cray.
Yes.
And it was your connection with South Dakota that got you the job?
Well, it turned out she really was a Westerner. She was from Seattle and loved the West. And, in fact, one of the few New Yorkers I ever met, now that I think about it, who had a map of the entire United States on her office wall. I mean, she always had a national vision. And so, but, you know, I didn't know how rare that was at the time. I interviewed with her, and she basically found out the only thing that really interested her was that I was going the next day to visit my grandparents in South Dakota. I was flying to South Dakota, and so she had to ask me. I had to point out, I had to sort of climb on her desk and point out this little town in South Dakota where I was going, because she was really interested. And then it turned out that, like, she'd had a brother who was born in Denver. Her father was an engineer who helped lay out the Continental Divide. And then she said I had the job. I mean, she didn't even ask me if I could type. But just the fact that, well, later she told me she wanted to make sure I wasn't a typical artsy Bennington girl.
Yeah.
But with my roots, it was South Dakota. I'm sure that my roots in South Dakota are what got me that job in New York. I'm convinced of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, amazing things that...
Yeah. And I suppose a lot of us, if we thought we were going to go and interview for this job, we'd try and look the part of an artsy girl from Bennington.
I didn't know. I didn't even know how. And I think I wore a little wool pantsuit that my grandmother had sewed for me. I mean, I think it was just really simple. And that was the other thing, you see. It was a very cold day. It was in December, and I had worn very practical clothing. I was not stylish. And I think that was the other thing. I looked, you know, I looked like a college girl who was trying to dress practically. And I thought, Betty, that again, I think, you know, in the Midwest and the West, we think that way. In New York City, you know, if it's, you know, 20 degrees and icy, you wear your stiletto heels because you want to look good. I mean, it's crazy.
Hmm. Okay, so your roots, they were in South Dakota. That's where your family was from. That's where you spent your early childhood. And then high school in Honolulu.
Yeah,
then...
I was a Navy brat. See, my parents were both raised in South Dakota, but they met at Northwestern. So Chicago is, and they eloped, actually. They eloped to Wheaton, Illinois. My father sometimes says it's the most fun anyone ever had in Wheaton. they eloped, and but then he joined the Navy. He was a Navy band director, so I actually was born in Washington, D.C., and we lived in Waukegan from when I was second grade through junior high, like through seventh grade. So we lived near Chicago for about 5 years. And then he got the band at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. So that's what landed us in Hawaii. But South Dakota was always like, that was the place, at least until we moved to Hawaii. That's where I always spent my childhood summers. And now, you know, 25 years ago, I returned to that house. It's the house my mother was raised in. That's where I've been living.
Well, what was it like for you as a youngster making those transitions in culture and geography?
Very painful. And you know, like moving from Virginia to Illinois. I mean, I was a shy kid anyway, and a lot of it was like, am I ever going to find friends again? You know, that sort of thing. The biggest culture shock, of course, was going from Hawaii to Vermont. And the rural atmosphere was soothing. Bennington is in a very beautiful, beautiful location. But I really had no idea when I went there that really the school is like an extension of New York City or maybe Boston, that the people there are very urban in their attitudes, and many of them are, and that I was really plugging into this sort of hyperactive cultural milieu on the East Coast. That was a profound culture shock, because really Hawaii tends to be a fairly provincial, laid-back place. And all of a sudden people were moving fast and talking about, you know, their shrinks, you know, that they had, they were 15, and they just seemed to be a lot more grown up than I was.
Yeah.
Anyways.
But while Honolulu and Hawaii were more provincial than the East Coast, at the same time, you were the new kid, and you were an outsider.
Yeah, you know, there was one girl from Montana at Bennington, and we sort of linked arms and talked about how strange people were in the East. I think there was another girl from, one girl from Colorado. There were just a few of us who adventured there, and we sort of got together and talked about how odd it was. And we all loved the school. I mean, I don't want to knock the college, because it really got me on the road to being a writer, and I learned a lot there, both in terms of literature and in terms of music and also human nature. That the whole first part of this memoir really is writing about what I learned about people, you know, in, those 4 years at Bennington.
Yeah. It seems while that time was very difficult, it helped shore up your inner core.
I think so. I wasn't aware of it at the time. I think, you know, and I think that's true of most college kids, you know, that when you're in the throes of it, you really don't have much perspective except that, oh, God, I hope I get through this. You know, it's just very, very difficult. And, of course, you always think that you're the only one who's feeling so isolated and alone. And, of course, the truth is that a lot of kids are having problems. And it is that classic passage from childhood and the teenagers to adulthood. And, you know, after I left the Bennington and got my first real job in New York, that was a big transition, you know, again, to very urban atmosphere and, you know, professional expectations, because that's really quite different from what is expected of you on a college campus. So I tried to tell some pretty good stories about it in the book, like hanging up on W.H. Auden, cutting W.H. Auden off on the phone when he was actually at a payphone and had used his last coins. I mean, you learn not to do things like that.
Oh, I felt my cheeks color at that when I read that.
I'll never forget it. I just, you know. I did meet him after that, but I never confessed, because you know, he did something at the Academy. I never confessed that I was the one who had done that.
Mm.
But
it was at Bennington that you began to write poetry. What drew you to poetry at Bennington?
Well, really, one professor named Ben Bellett, who was a poet himself. And see, that's one of the wonderful things about Bennington is that all the literature courses are taught by writers. Howard Nemiroff had been there. Bernard Malamud, the novelist, was teaching there. So it was very inspiring in a way. I mean, I thought of literature sort of being on the page as being something you studied and you had to take a test and on it. But here was a living poet talking about poetry and language in a whole different way, because he was living it. And that really was, he was the one who encouraged me to start writing poetry.
Mm. What did you write about?
I had to write a description of someone using no adjectives. That was that was literally an assignment. And that was a lot of fun because I had a very energetic, sort of hyperactive roommate. And it was fun to describe, like, the effect that she had on a room when she walked in it, you know, that she was just buzzing, you know. And then, I don't know, then I sort of had first romance things, feelings, you know, all those things that you think poetry is, you have to express your feelings. I think most of what I started writing at Bennington was adolescent. But then when I realized I was going to New York, I wrote an angel handbook. It's a handbook for angels assigned to New York City, to duty in New York City, and the kinds of things that they must do. And I realized I was really trying to reassure myself that New York City would be survivable, that it would be an okay place. And I would consider that probably my first adult poem. I mean, the first poem that I really conceived of. I wasn't just being a gawky teenager, you know, in love or something. This poem had something going on that other people responded to. So that it felt like my first public poem in a way.
Yeah. In the book, I think it's very interesting that you say at when you look back over your early work, you wonder what in fact you were saying. I think you use the word knotted to describe your early poetry.
Knotted and masked, you know, knotted up and masked. And in fact, I actually, the rare occasions when I do teach writing workshops, I take some of the poems that I published in the Bennington Literary Magazine as examples of really bad poetry. And people just laugh. I mean, it's so obviously bad.
Do you remember a
stanza?
Kind of
nice. It has a nice sound. I think that's what the people in the magazine took it, because it sounded like it meant something, but it really didn't that much. And I don't remember what it means, but even what I had in mind, this is like 35 years ago. Yeah. But I wrote it, so I can't even tell anymore. But it was all a step on the journey. You know, it was my apprenticeship, I guess.
So what allowed you to loosen those knots?
I think largely the influence of Betty Cray, also just the fact that I was hearing so much good poetry read aloud, both at the Academy readings, and I would go other places to hear poets, and I was reading a lot of poetry, and I began to realize, you know, that what I was doing, my ambitions were too small. I mean, I was sort of trying to express myself when I really needed to be observing the world and other people and writing about that.
Mm.
That helped a great deal. And I wanted people to be able to read my poems or hear my poems and understand something of it and respond, make their own responses.
You've got a new collection just out.
Yes, titled 30 years worth of
Journey.
Journey.
Maybe you would, if you have it there with you, would you read something for us?
Yes. I'm fascinated by... let's see, what should I read? I'll read a poem about about moving to South Dakota called Harvest. And my husband and I had moved there and haunted by the past. We were actually in my grandparents' house. Here's a poem called Harvest. We'll never belong. The pheasant steps out of a medieval tapestry into South Dakota. This gravel road is a thread the fates cast down. In 1897, my great-grandmother was buried for $12.50. I have the receipt, some dress pieces, the strands of her hair my grandfather kept hidden for nearly 80 years. He died then, and I cut the sleeves of his long johns to make a cover for my rolling pin. His old truck wheezes once and sputters forward. The combine spits out dust. What will anyone make of us, two childless figures in a field?
Harvest.
Harvest.
Harvest. From Kathleen Norris's new collection of poetry, Journey, New and Selected Poems, 1969 to 1999. Kathleen's memoir, The Virgin of Bennington, is also just out. And we're talking with her about her poetry, about her memoir. Listeners, I encourage you to join us this afternoon. If you've got a question or comment, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL, 333-WILL. Kathleen is in Chicago today. This evening at 7:30, she'll give a reading at Bookstall in Winnetka, Illinois. That's set for 7:30 this evening. So what was New York City like when you arrived there?
Well, it was a lot of fun because I had a free place to stay with a dancer from Bennington, a college friend who was cat-sitting and plant-sitting at a loft in Chinatown. And so it was very exotic. Of course, Chinatown felt like Honolulu to me. It was familiar. The other thing was that most evenings I would come home and this dancer's troupe would be there at the apartment, stretching all over, and because there was a huge dance space, a dance floor at the back of the apartment. I could watch them rehearse, you know, and so it felt kind of communal. I didn't feel alone. And then a roommate from, you know, it was just a very exciting city. I zipped around on the subways. I went to poetry readings. One of the good things for me was there were a number of other kids from Bennington there, you know, friends. So I wasn't totally alone. I roomed with a friend of mine who was going to Juilliard after Bennington, and she had a lot of musician friends. So it was just a very lively time. One of my claims to fame is that I went to Patti Smith's first performance of her poetry to a rock and roll beat. You know, the sort of the punk style that she invented, and I think it was 1971. It was very exciting that, you know, that here was somebody who was doing this with poetry. I've since seen this referred to as like a milestone in the history of punk rock and all this stuff, and I think, well, I was there, and it was fun. It was, you knew something new had happened. So, but at the time, we were all just, you know, struggling writers in our 20s, just hanging out and reading each other, hearing each other. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And you knew some folks from the Andy Warhol crowd?
Well, Patti Smith would have been sort of connected with that. And the photographer, the man who took the Gerard Malanga, a poet and a photographer, who is still a friend of mine, was one that his interests were largely literary. So I had probably more in common with him than with a lot of the other people in that crowd. And the other thing was that Gerard wasn't so heavily into drugs as so many of the other people. I mean, And I wasn't either. I just, in a sense, I just needed more sleep. You know, these people were all on speed, and that's one drug I absolutely can't take. I mean, one cup of coffee will send me spinning. So I kind of was very much on the fringe of that scene, and survived it, I guess, is what I'd say now.
Yeah. There is a wonderful photograph of you that Gerard took that is on the back of the jacket.
Yeah, I was so glad that they used that. I tell the story of that day. It was Christmas morning, and it was snowing lightly in Central Park, and Gerard didn't have a lot of money then for film, and for some reason he decided to film me. I mean, I had one book of poems coming out, but, you know, that was it. I wasn't well known, and I was impressed that he used up a whole roll of film, and I was just overjoyed when I showed it to my editor, and she said, oh, we have to use that. It's taken at the Delacorte Fountain with this angel at the top, and it's just very... The ironic thing is I look very sad in the photograph, and I was actually having a good day. I think of that as one of the best Christmases of my life. But that whole year had been extremely painful because I won a first book competition, you know, for a book of poetry. I had this book of poems published, and my roommate and some other people in my life just sort of dropped out. They were so jealous that they just did weird things. It was very, very difficult. It was like, you know, I was very young, and in a sense, my success was coming too early for me to handle. And so that's the story of that year that I tell in that book. I mean, it was useful because I found out a lot about who my true friends were, but it was also a shocking and difficult thing to cope with. You know, when someone you've known a while and you think is a friend, you know, becomes very jealous and acts very strange because, you know, you've done something or you've gotten ahead and they haven't. And it was just, that really was probably one of the most difficult years of my life.
Yeah, you didn't know to give that instruction to the angels.
No, nothing about first books. But it was all, you know, grist, as Yeats said about, you know, running for serving in the Irish Parliament. It was all grist for my mill. I mean, it wasn't a lost year. I learned a great deal. It was just a very painful time. And I think that does happen. Sometimes when you're very young and you succeed, you don't know how to handle it. And other people in your life don't know how to handle it either. So it was just, in fact, I tell the story about a poet who came, I think William Harmon from North Carolina, had won an Academy Award, and he was shocked because I was giving him a mic test at the museum, Guggenheim Museum, where he was going to read, and I was doing all these things, but I hadn't even told him I was a poet, let alone that I had a first book coming out. And he said to Betty Cray, well, I would think any young poet would be shouting this from the rooftop.
Right.
She had to tell him I was a poet. And I finally, this year, explained to him why that was. I said I had so many negative reactions, so much trouble, because I was having a book published, that I just stopped talking about it.
Some years ago, I interviewed a writer who said, who teaches writing, and he said that for some people that he taught who were wonderful writers, they would never let go of their work. And I wonder if that's that fear of the baggage that goes along with success is part of that reluctance.
I was too dumb. I mean, if I'd known better, maybe I would have tried to hold on to it. I let it go. I let it be published. I thought it was very exciting in that sense. I was happy to have the book out. If I'd had my wits about me, I may have waited longer. I mean, it is, I think, a fairly immature book, that very first book called Falling Off. But Betty Cray, again, helped me revise it, and I think she did help me make it the best book that I could make at that time. There are a few poems from Falling Off in this new and selected volume. I did, you know, pick about, I don't know, 5 or 10 that seemed okay now. I mean, they have stood the test of time.
In The Virgin of Bennington, you write, after that book was published, Falling Off, you lost your voice to bouts of laryngitis.
Yeah, I did. I lost my voice literally to laryngitis, and then I really couldn't write. I don't think, after that book came out in 71, I don't think I wrote anything worthwhile for another 3 years. I tried, but I knew it was just dead on the page. It just wasn't doing anything, and I did find it. That was another thing. Betty was very encouraging. She said, you know, take your time. Another poet, James Tate, who was, I think he was only 21 when his first book was published, he told me the same thing had happened to him and not to worry about it. So, you know, that was encouraging. But it also, and it was, in a sense, you know, when a drought comes on the prairie, the grasses die down to the roots.
Mm-hmm.
They seem dead, but they're not. And the minute rain comes, boy, they just green up very, very fast. They take full advantage of the rain, and that's the metaphor I like for what happens often with writing, that you seem really dead, you seem like nothing is working, and then the minute a little spark comes and you're ready for it, you know, you can write again. And so my next book of poems, you know, my first one was in 1971, the next one came out a full 10 years later, but it was the right time. I mean, I think that was a good, I needed that 10 years between those two books,
yeah,
to grow up a little, just to a lot of other things.
And you were also, during this time, you were also learning a lot about poetry.
Oh, absolutely. I still am. I think, you know, it's a subject that I will never know enough about. My unfortunate circumstance now, I mean, I don't get to hear as much of it read aloud anymore. I don't get to go to very many poetry readings. But it's still a real pleasure, because poetry is meant to be heard aloud. If it's just on the page and it's just an academic exercise, it can get kind of dead.
Yeah. Betty Cray helped you learn about poetry at this stage in your life, post-1971, post-Falling Off the Earth, when she gave you an assignment to go back through papers that were in the academy that teachers had written about their experiences of going into classrooms.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the most wonderful things. Betty was the pioneer. She actually sponsored the very first Poetry in the Schools program in the country. It was a little pilot program in 1966, and she hired a bunch of young writers. They ended up going into half the high schools in New York City, including the vocational schools. And she had people like Kathleen Fraser, Galway Connell, Ishmael Reed, June Jordan. A lot of people would go in and read and talk about their work, and they were a poet. Paul Blackburn was another one. But hidden, sort of hidden away in the academy offices were all the reports that these poets would have had filed. And I still love reading them. I mean, I've read them many times now, but that was one of my favorite things. I would sort of poke around in those files and read, you know, Kathleen Fraser's account of going to a girls' school where it was basically a school for girls who wanted to be in the fashion industry or beauticians. And a lot of their questions to her concerned where she got her clothes. They liked her clothes, and was she a rebel? And, you know, is that why you write poems, because you're a rebel? I mean, they had these wonderful, non-literary, passionate questions for her, and she wrote that up. And Ishmael Reed took in, you know, some stuff, songs by Bob Dylan and some jazz pieces, and it was just so fascinating for me to read that poetry could do this, you know, that poetry meant something, you know, to other people. It could. And that's still, I mean, I just love those. And I was able to quote quite a few of those reports in my book.
Yeah. We've got a listener who's waiting to talk with us this afternoon on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Hi, Miss Norris.
Hi.
Thank you for sharing poetry with us.
Oh, thank you.
I missed the intro. I have a question. Are you an English professor?
I never have been. I have a bachelor's degree in literature from Bennington College, and that is the extent of my formal training, I guess, in literature.
Wonderful. Then you are the person to ask this for me to ask this question. It seems like from little I know of modern American contemporary American poetry, seems like most of the published poets are English professors. I mean, probably for good reason. I just want to hear your comment about it. And also, it seems like you're saying you're relating your connection with lots of contemporary poets and also about their relationship. It seems like really a tight-knit community. It's like everybody know everybody else, and they're either friends or some even lovers. And
well, not really. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that I mention in the book that I read and don't know, and people that I knew just because I was living and working in New York City for those 6 years. But, I mean, I don't see them much. I maybe correspond once a year at Christmas. I mean, I don't think it really is a close community. I think it's a very loose-knit community. And what happens with the writers, since the 1970s, when Masters of Fine Arts programs began sort of proliferating, I mean, there were a few before then, but then they really bloomed, and so many colleges offer this, it became more common for people to graduate from those programs and then go and teach poetry or teach literature. I think there's a natural mix between the love of literature and the love of writing poetry. So, I mean, I think you're always going to find quite a few poets who are professors, mm-hmm. but that really has become much more common since the period I'm writing about, since the early 1970s. It always interested me that James Wright, who was a marvelous poet, refused to teach poetry. He would only teach courses in the novel.
Oh.
You know, I thought that was a good choice, because poetry was what he did because he loved it and was passionate about it and wanted to keep that sort of separate from anything that he taught. He was passionate about those 18th century novels I mentioned in that course, but
he was passionate about
teaching too, but he never wanted to mix the two, and I always thought that was probably a wise thing.
Wow, that's amazing. Actually, I know an English professor here did exactly the same thing. People never even knew he write poetry. He write beautiful poetry.
And then there are other people like Stanley Kunitz, who taught at the Columbia MFA program and inspired so many different writers, and so many different writers who had their own individual voices. I mean, Gregory Orr would be one. He taught there for so long. Daniel Halpern, I think, was there. But there's so many people that he taught and really inspired them to become, you know, writers and follow the vocation. And none of them sound like him, you know, and that's the mark of a very great teacher.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 1-800-222-9455. From the Virgin of Bennington, Kathleen, I'd like you to read a section about poetry in the classroom.
Oh, yes, I'll be happy to.
And now I seem to have lost Kathleen Norris, talking with us this afternoon. Well, I'm getting the signal to stretch. Let me take up here this section of the Virgin of Bennington as time is growing short. I'll start from the top. Poetry does not rest easily in the school curriculum, where it is chained to the study of grammar and even handwriting practice. It is still common in elementary schools to find the worst lines of Longfellow used to teach cursive writing. The students who make the neatest copies of the poem are rewarded by having their work placed in school hallways. The others, not unreasonably, conclude that poetry is irrelevant. Poetry is an art that can never be fully contained in the classroom. For in William Stafford's words, the poem will always be a wild animal. There is something about it that won't yield to ordinary learning. When a poem catches you, it overwhelms, it surprises, it shakes you up, and often you can't provide any usual explanation for its power. My own education in poetry followed an ordinary track. I had loved it as a small child, taking pleasure in reciting nursery rhymes and the like. But by eighth grade, I had decided that poetry was beyond me, and I grew frustrated at trying to decipher the hidden meanings that my teacher said would become clear after repeated readings. Poetry didn't seem worth the effort. It wasn't wild at all, just a stupid intellectual game that poets played at the expense of school children. It took an experienced practitioner of the art, Ben Belate, to start me on the road to conversion. As my first literature professor at Bennington, he began to dismantle much of what I had learned about poetry in the previous 12 years. And after he encouraged me to write it myself, he guided me through my initial confrontation with the essential problem of poetry, that of finding the right words, those that offer the reader an experience that can't be stated in any other way. As Donald Hall has noted in Poetry, the Unsayable said, quote, "The unsayable builds a secret room in the best poems. This room is not a hidden meaning to be paraphrased by the intellect. It conceals itself from reasonable explanation. The secret room is something to acknowledge, to accept and honor in a silence of assent. The secret room is where the unsayable gathers, and it is poetry's uniqueness." That from the Virgin of Bennington, Kathleen Norris's coming-of-age memoir, which is just out from Riverhead Books. Kathleen Norris, do we have you back on the line? No, we don't. My apologies. And it looks like I don't know if we will get her back this afternoon. Anyway, let me tell you that Kathleen has this new book out, The Virgin of Bennington, from Riverhead Books. Also just out a new collection of poetry, Journey, New and Selected Poems, 1969 to 1999. That collection is published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. And Kathleen Norris, I'm told, is now back
I'm
on
back
the line.
On. Yes, I got bumped off.
I'm sorry about that. I feel like I've just done something that you did at the Academy of Poets. When
well, you know, poetry is a, no, you know, it could be a plot. No, you know, everyone is against poetry, so maybe that's what happened.
I don't know. But again, I'm sorry. And I read for the audience that section.
Oh, great. Thank you.
That section. So I think that's you know, there's so much in this book, so much about poetry, you know, and its power and about poets. And folks like...
And mentoring. You know,
mentoring.
And one of the sub-themes of the book is really how Middle Westerners and Westerners adapt or do not adapt to the East Coast. You know, because even Robert Bly, you know, who's so associated with Minneapolis and Minnesota, you know, he as a young poet, he came to New York for a few years and then left. And I did that. Larry Wywoody, the novelist, you know, did that. It just seems to be a magnet for young people, and some of them stay in New York, and Betty and her husband, you know, had stayed there since the 50s and worked in the arts, but I decided to leave, and Betty Cray was the only person I knew in Manhattan who understood that moving to South Dakota made sense.
Mm.
A wonderful idea
yeah.
for me as a writer, and probably as a person, too.
We've got another listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Charleston.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling for sentimental reasons. We moved from South Dakota here to Illinois about 3 years ago, and I got in late on your conversation, so I'm sorry I didn't hear all of it, but when you said South Dakota, I miss it so badly. We're not from there, but we lived 7 years there.
What part of South Dakota?
Well, we lived 3 years in Rapid City, where my daughter was born, and then 4 years in Brookings, where both my husband and I taught.
Of course, Rapid City's right at the edge of the Black Hills, which really are lovely. Yeah, I know. It's funny, you know, I'm in Hawaii over the winters, and if I have to stay too long, like I did this year, my husband wasn't well, and I kept saying, you know, when spring came, I said, I really miss South Dakota. And look at you funny. You know, you're in Honolulu. I said, no, I miss my garden. I miss the spring.
Yes, I miss the air there in the Black Hills.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe now Cloister Walk, is it your book?
Yeah, Cloister Walk is my second book.
Yes, and I'm sorry that I haven't read it, but all my friends had and raved about it.
Well, actually, the first book I wrote is called Dakota. It's really about South Dakota. You might want to start with that one.
Uh-huh.
Because I wrote it after living there for about 15 years, and nobody who was living in that region of western South Dakota was really writing about it, and I just, you know, wrote that book because there were so many stories out there I had to tell.
Uh-huh.
That was actually my first book about 7 or 8 years ago now, and now I'm sort of going, the new book, it's called The Virgin of Bennington, and it's sort of about the period before that when I decided to leave Manhattan and New York City, the East Coast where I'd been to college. I had decided to leave and move to South Dakota.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sort of going the wrong way around. It took me a long time to actually get to tell this part of the story.
Uh-huh. Well, the best part about South Dakota, I think, is, to me, it felt like no other place. We moved there from Dallas. And Dallas, to me, Atlanta feels like Dallas, and a lot of urban areas have the same shops and restaurants and things like that. But South Dakota,
it's still unique. It still has a kind of unique atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And see, we're not big enough for the chain stores to even notice. I mean, there's no people there. I think there's 1.3 million people in both states together, North and South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I would have to go about 90 miles to the nearest McDonald's, and that's fine with me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had students, I taught at a university as an instructor, and I had the hardest working students. They put me to shame, and I think that homesteading heritage is still with the students there.
Yeah, I think so, too, and you can see where, you know, for somebody from a background like that or a fairly, you know, quiet, sane sort of background, you go to the East Coast to college, and you have a lot of adjustment. You would probably have a lot of adjustment trying to come even to Chicago. I mean, it's just so much larger and faster and bigger. There's just a lot to get over if you're a young person, especially.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. We're drawing down on our time. We're here at the end. Was it a big transition for you going back to South Dakota?
You know, it was such a relief because I really think I had stayed just long enough in Manhattan. It was so good to get to the quiet, to see stars at night. And also, you know, I was just married. I mean, it was a very good way to start building the marriage. And that's part of the story, of course, I tell in the new book, to have some quiet space around us to build our own relationship, my husband and myself.
Mm.
So there were odd things about it, and certainly South Dakota winters are not for wimps. But but there were difficulties. But my husband became a bartender right away, and so right away he felt, you know, at
connected
home, in a sense.
Yeah.
Got to know people.
Yeah, right. One more question before we go. The young poets of today, who would you list? How are they faring?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of wonderful variety. There's a whole movement of people writing very formal verse now. Very exciting people. Sherrod Santos, I think, is down in Missouri. I love him. Jane Hirschfield is a wonderful poet from California. There's just a lot. There's a lot of ferment, a lot going on. Kate Daniels is another poet I absolutely love down at Oberlin, Ohio, Lynn Powell. I mean, I'm always finding good stuff, and and of course you stay a young poet until you're about 90 and then you die. I mean, it's wonderful. You can be a young poet forever. Sam Hamill has a beautiful book out called Gratitude that I had the good fortune to review last year. I really don't know anything about him, but it was just a kind of a Buddhist-influenced book, but just such beautiful poems. And so I'm really quite inspired by poetry right now. I think there's just a lot of very good activity. There's Rafael Campo is another poet. He's actually a physician. He's a Cuban-American guy. He's a physician, and he writes sonnets that are just to die for. They're beautiful. And so there's just so much variety right now and activity in poetry that I think it's very exciting. Mm.
Well, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure. Kathleen Norris has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Virgin of Bennington, just out from Riverhead Press. Also, she is the author of she's got a new collection of poetry out called Journey, New and Selected Poems, 1969 to 1999. That is published by the University of Pittsburgh Press.